Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome to another ChrisMartinson.com production. I'm your host, Chris Martinson, and today we have the pleasure of talking with Paul Tustain, founder and CEO of Bullion Vault, and a respected gold market analyst and commentator. Hey, welcome, Paul. It's a real pleasure to have you.
Well, it's a pleasure to be asked.
Terrific. Can we start? I'd love to start with a brief history of yourself and how it is that you came to create Bullion Vault and why you did.
Well, I was a computer science graduate, and I spent about 20 years in systems in the City of London. Built my first business between sort of 1990 and 2000, and I was selling that in about 2000, just as the British government was selling our national gold reserve, and that sort of drew my attention to gold for the first time. And I tried to buy some. Price then was a little under $300 an ounce, and it was very difficult, very expensive, and perhaps worst of all, the gold that was being sold to me was unallocated. And I fairly quickly realized that the gold market infrastructure was significantly underdeveloped, and that was probably because gold had been on the slide for 20 years, so nobody had been investing in it. That was up to about 2000. And it was particularly underdeveloped for private investors.
But how did you have to buy it when you say buy it? What was the process for you?
I went to a Swiss bank, and it was amusing, actually, because the private banker was very insistent that the gold was, or that everything that they did was all custodian. And so I dutifully bought gold from them, and it turned out that gold was the one exception. It was the one thing which was done on their balance sheet through an unallocated gold program. So we had to switch out of that, which cost still more money, and eventually ended up with some of the big gold bars.
Hmm. So all right. So you're trying to get gold in this market, and first of all, there's something not quite right about it. Allocation, for people who aren't familiar with it, means that when you own gold, there is a bar. It has a number on it, and that bar is fully allocated, meaning you are attached to it. There's a legal connection between you and that bar. Unallocated means somebody says, hey, I've just sold you some gold, and it's mixed in with all these other people's gold, and I may or may not be able to tell you what numbers are on the bars or anything specific. Is that about right?
It's about right. The key difference between the two of them is that unallocated gold means you are a creditor. You are on the balance sheet of the provider, which means if the provider goes bust, you lose your gold. That's the key thing, the key difference. Mm-hmm. Allocated gold means your gold is stored in a custody relationship, which is fundamentally different in law. You own it outright. You pay for the service of having it looked after in what's called safekeeping. And if the provider were to go bust, you continue to own it outright. And so the liquidator has to give you all your property back, not just sort of, you know, six cents on the dollar.
Excellent. No, that's a very important difference. So you recently released a video presentation. It was titled Gold, Where to Now? And it was detailing your outlook for gold. We'll get to the specifics of that in a moment, but first I want to step back here. Introduce our listeners to your thesis for why investing in precious metals is a good idea. You know, what are the important fundamentals to be aware of here?
Well, for me, I think the most important fundamental with gold is just how rare and stable the gold supply is. Mm-hmm. As I think lots of people know now, all the gold in the world would form a cube of about 20 meters in edge, and that wouldn't quite cover a tennis court. People love saying how useless gold is, and of course it is more or less useless in industrial terms, but yet the same people happily pay for something with a $100 bill, and how industrially useless is a piece of paper. So I guess the point in terms of the fundamental quality is that that both money and gold are industrially useless, but they have this very good social use, which is holding value, which is essential to trade. But they only work while they're in very stable supply. And of course, while currencies are fairly regularly corrupted, gold can't be. You just can't print more of the stuff.
Right. So central banks have you know, famously were on record during the London gold pool period of trying to manipulate the price of gold after Bretton Woods was sort of falling apart. And then there was, you know, notions of calling it a barbarous relic and all of this. But despite all of this rhetoric, central banks seem to have held on to quite a bit of their gold through that process. And I'm a big believer in following what people do before I follow what they say. Is it fair to say that central banks are still holding gold as a monetary asset and for no other purpose?
Well, I think that's about right. I would say that perhaps 10 years ago, particularly the European banks under the Washington Agreement, had agreed to dispose of some of their gold reserves. In European currency terms, it had become irrelevantly small as a part of their currency base. So they were selling it. Now, that became increasingly embarrassing for them because, of course, all their other currency assets and foreign exchange reserves were falling in value while gold was rising. So that has pretty much fallen into disuse now. The European banks are no longer selling. And, of course, the Far East is buying, Russia is buying, the oil exporters are buying. And so if you take the gold used in central banks as a whole across the globe, you'd find it was pretty stable at around about 30,000 tons. And there's this gradual shift, which has now slowed to a trickle from west to east. And with the East buying, they're really buying new supply. So now what's happened is the central bank gold holdings have started to increase again.
Right. So this is probably a pretty important trend. I mean, that's a seismic shift going from being dishoarders to reaccumulators of gold at the central bank level. You started buying below 300. Here we are at 1,400, bumping into 1,450 today, I believe, at this point. So what are the other trends, though, that were in play through that time to drive us from 300 to 1,400? What else was in there besides this shift in attitudes at the central bank level?
Well, if you look at the data again, the key shift has been the change in the demand for gold from private investment. So if you wind the clock back about 8 years, you'll see that private investment was probably bumping along at 400 tons a year. That's running around about 1,300 to 1,400 tons a year. And in fact, last year overtook jewelry demand for the first time. So that means in the course of about 8 years, there's probably been about a 10,000 ton increase in private reserves, which has taken it up to more or less the same level as public reserves or central bank reserves of gold. So that's been a seismic shift, as you put it. And of course, at the same time, we're seeing monetary corruption in all the major currencies. One of the things that I tend to think of here is there's this word protectionism from history, from back in the 1930s, which is widely a dirty word. But protectionism was all about raising import tariffs or barriers to imports so that you could protect local jobs and the local economy. Essentially, devaluing your currency is exactly the same thing. You devalue your currency to raise a price tariff against imports. And that's what's been going on competitively throughout the Western world for the last 6 or 7 years. So you've got the currencies, all the major currencies of the world, in a race to the bottom, all being corrupted by increasing supply. And then you've got gold just sitting there, expanding its supply through mining output at a rate of about 1.5% per annum. So it's a much more stable monetary store than the currencies we've had. I think there's another point which I quite like to mention, which is what's happened over a 25-year period from about 1980 was, of course, what I call the golden age of the microchip. Now, the microchip was increasing productivity around the world at something like 4% per annum, which meant that all other things being equal, we would have seen the cost of goods reducing by something like 4% per annum. But during that period, the central bankers had a pretty easy mandate to control inflation, usually somewhere between 1% or maybe 2% in the UK. And that gave them something like 6 percentage points to play with. And that meant that they could expand the monetary aggregates fairly freely and yet not see inflation because computer microchips were lowering the cost of production everywhere. So that monetary expansion basically all got frozen into typically long-term bonds, which were very attractive because interest rates were falling and inflation was low. And that's produced a ton of bonds, basically $100 trillion worth of bonds, which are attractive only while you've got this low level of inflation and low level of interest rates. But the golden age of the microchip is probably increasingly running out of steam now. And what you're left with is a habit of producing monetary excess at the rate of 6%. And in the meantime, you've got this great pile of money stored in bonds, which is becoming unstable.
Well, the bonds in aggregate kind of depend on getting paid back in order to have their value. And in order to pay bonds back, you have to have a future that can deliver the goods there. And so, you know, what we have baked into our giant bond portfolio is an assumption about future growth and economic growth, which hasn't really borne out in the past number of years. And now there's an enormous set of wrinkles in that story with energy, oil particularly, et cetera. But even now, if we look at what's happening in Japan, with the world's third largest economy, basically is going to downshift, I think, from third into reverse rather suddenly. The growth story gets difficult. So it really does complicate the expansionary monetary policies and coupled to that, I think, the debt policies of various governments all around the world that got quite used to easy times, being able to spend beyond means, year after year after year. That kind of got baked into expectations, institutional philosophies, even investment philosophies, all of that. So all of that has to be rethought. And I've always considered gold was going to be one of the early barometers to sort of call the charade for what it was. And so that's part of the message I receive from gold, is that it's telling us something. And it's telling us something about both past policy and what we're likely to experience next. How hard is it going to be for us to shift from the past 20 years of how we've been expanding into whatever we have to do next, which I assume can't expand nearly as fast? How does that work for us?
Well, I'm not sure that it does work. I'm not sure that it's possible, which is why gold is like a beacon. It's a signal that the monetary system is in grave danger. I agree with you that you have to find a source that is going to match or exceed the rate of growth that we had in the microchips golden age. But I don't see anything that's capable of producing that. So what you end up with is a very high debt economy, which we've clearly got to. I mean, I think it's worth looking at those numbers in terms of public debt. The U.S. public debt, I'm going to talk about the U.S., although the U.K. is on, broadly speaking, similar terms.
Right.
The U.S. public debt is currently somewhere around $14 trillion. That's the government's debt, $14 trillion. On schedule, now the schedule is an interesting thing in itself because this is anticipating 4% per annum GDP growth in each of 2011, 12, 13, and 14. I don't see the engine for that growth, particularly not with falling house prices. But if they get that growth, and only if they get that growth, they could hold the deficit down to budget deficits of about $800 billion a year. That means in about 8 years, on schedule, we should hit a $20 trillion public debt in the United States. Now, when numbers get that large, you have to start doing some transformations to make them make sense to, well, at least I do. I have to make this thing make sense to me. And the way I do that is I assume that $20 trillion, I just assume, okay, what would happen if we had to pay interest rates of something like 6% on that? Now, that's not an unreasonable rate, 6%. It's historically reasonably typical. And 6% of $20 trillion is $1.2 trillion. Well, if you divide that by 120 million U.S. households, you come up with a figure of $10,000 per household. Now, that's the tax bill just for paying the interest on a $20 trillion debt. Now, the 6% assumption I use in that needs to be compared against Paul Volcker's chosen rate when he decided to get inflation under control. He took interest rates up to 18%, which was about 4% above the then level of inflation. It just shows you that 6% is a very conservative assumption, but it's completely uncollectible. And what this means is that when you've got a public debt up at the $20 trillion level, up at those sorts of numbers, it becomes effectively impossible to run a meaningful counterinflation policy. So I think what you're going to see is ever more quantitative easing. I think it'll be very difficult to exit. There's nobody to buy the debt which is being printed by the government. I think it's very difficult to exit it, and steadily things get worse and worse.
So in 1729, Voltaire said that paper money eventually returns to its intrinsic value, zero. And if from this recent commentary here, it sounds like what we're on is we're on a path towards basically destroying the currency because we're in a box at this point in time. We have to print up this amount in order to keep the game going. But if we print up that much, what we're going to end up doing is ruining the currency. If we don't print up that much, we risk sliding into watching that debt go into a default scenario, a cascading default. Honestly, between the two, I think that a default is feared more in the U.S. than an inflationary outcome. Everybody fights their last battle, I guess. You know, the Great Depression, that's what we're fighting. Even though, you know, inflation is possibly the greater monster. In deflation, I see deflation, that's your opportunity to rinse out all the bad decisions you've made. Inflation is, I guess, your opportunity to kick the can down the road. I think we're going to kick the can down the road, most likely. Would you, that's your assessment, if I characterize that right?
I think it's very likely, because I think it's almost an inevitable consequence of the modern construction of democracy. I'm a huge fan of democracy, but I do think democracy needs to be strongly constituted. And the sad problem with the way it's constituted both in Europe and in the United States is that all elections are fought at the boundary of responsible debt. If you don't go up to that boundary, if you try to offer austerity to an electorate, the other guy looks far more generous and he gets elected, and for all your good intentions, your monetary discipline is consigned to the dustbin. That's the problem, and that's what sort of leads you inexorably towards an inflationary future. But in fact, the point that I've been trying to make is that what we'll hear from governments as they print money is that it's a relatively modest amount of money that they're printing. And in fact, it is. That's perfectly true. But it hides the thing that's really going on. And this is the thing that really worries me. When you just print even a little bit of money, if you just print whatever it is, $700 billion or whatever, it sounds modest next to coins and notes of some $15 trillion in circulation. But it sends a very powerful message to savers. Now, if you look at that monetary stock, it's got this time element built into it. You think of the $100 trillion of bonds. They are basically spaced out over broadly about a 20-year period. Most of that money was frozen into the bond market freely by people who owned the debt. But they basically had this signal from QE that it's no longer safe to put money out to 20 years. And indeed, you'll see that the likes of PIMCO have basically withdrawn all their money from U.S. Treasuries because they think that it's so fatal. Now, what that means is that you give the markets that signal that you're going to print money whenever the going gets tough. But 18-year bonds or 20-year bonds are all still 18- and 20-year bonds. And the clock has to wind down, allowing those bonds to get to the short end. And you see steadily, and this has, of course, already happened in Greece, you see a mountain of money as it gets redeemed. Even a 20-year bond, which gets redeemed, is going to be reinvested in the short end. Nothing goes back out to 20 years. And so you get this hump of money at the short end, and short-end money behaves very much like cash. That's why it's kept at the short end. You can sell a short-dated bond for very near its cash value, its nominal value. You can't necessarily do that with a long-term bond. So with this pile of money at the short end, you've got, instead of having 20 trillion in coins and notes and near-term money, you suddenly go up to 120 trillion in coins and short-term notes. But getting there is going to take 15 years. And that's the point. The switch has been flicked, and it's not possible to unflick it. So that shift to the short end is clearly happening. If you look at quantitative easing now, it's essentially making the financing of bond purchases very cheap, but the bonds themselves are still, let's say, in the 15-year end. Anything from 7 years upwards is basically in the quantitative easing stock. But they're only being bought by banks because the banks can put them back to the central bank, because the central bank has got a mandate now to buy illiquid, long-dated quality bonds. So that's where they all end up. Everyone can exit and go back into cash, which is provided by the central bank when it buys these long-term bonds and converts all the holders' money back into cash. So it creates this mountain of short-term money. And this is why you get inflation and deflation at the same time. What you've got now is an increasing glut of short-term money, chasing all the things that people buy with short-term money, and that's things like your shopping basket or the gasoline for your car, but you've got a shortage of long-term money, and that's what you'd use, obviously, to buy a house. So your house, there being a shortage of money, is falling in price, but the things that you buy in your shopping basket, they're all increasing in price. So the inflation has sort of switched round from where it was in 2005, when it was the other way around, as all the money was swept out to the long end to finance house purchases. It's switched round now, and it now, but both ways, it hurts people who have savings. Their cost of living goes up, their assets go down in value, and their standard of living steadily slides as they compete on world markets for the commodities, the food, the clothing, the oil, that are the sort of compulsory purchases of life and which you're competing for on international markets with Asians who've now sitting on a stock of $2 trillion.
This is a great idea. I hadn't quite thought of it this way. Because I get in fairly routine arguments is perhaps too strong of a word, but debates, intellectual debates, and writing contests, as it were, around this whole inflation or deflation as if it's an either or. And I say it's yes, because I can point to both happening quite clearly at this point in time. I mean, if you take the CCI, the Continuous Commodity Index, and run it back 10 years and start drawing a line under it when it takes off in 2002 to today, it's a pretty straight line. And it's at 14% per annum over that period of time. And so that's in periods of a recession, all kinds of things. The deflationists look at the large monetary aggregates or credit and say, look, both are falling. Therefore, ergo, by definition, we're in deflation. I say, yeah, but look at all the things that are inflating. And the argument I've been trying to introduce is that government bonds behave like money. But I hadn't quite sectioned them into the short versus the long. I love that distinction.
Short-term, what's happening? It's sliding. The long-term money is sliding slowly towards the short end. And it looks to me like it's an unstoppable journey. It will get there, but it won't get there tomorrow. The clock has to wind down on that long-dated debt, and it all piles up at the short end. I mean, I don't know if you know the story from Germany. When they had their hyperinflation back in 1923, they started printing. That made long-dated debt extremely unattractive. And then it got to the extreme. So the long-dated debt starts to wind down. There was plenty of it. They'd financed their First World War on long-dated debt. And it started to wind down and all pile up at the short end. It was the same effective combination of the government, the central bank, and the banks. They were doing it in much the same way as we're doing it now. But as the money started to pile up, everybody was looking for short-term wealth stores rather than long-term ones because, fearing inflation through printing, they were worried that holding their money long-term, obviously it would lose value. And then it got really extreme because in the final analysis, you had money in current accounts, which you would think of as cash, but it wasn't cash because it took 5 days to pass through the banking system so that the seller of something could use that money he just received a check for. And 5 days was too long. So all people who had current accounts would go in and say, I need the banknotes today. So you ended up with a 20-year stock of money, all held in banknotes. Everything had compacted up to the short end. And the game was pass the parcel. What you would do, you wouldn't ever go into cash unless you'd already realized, you'd already decided where you were going to spend that money. And you would pass that cash on to the next person who'd also decided where they were going to spend that money. So there were great big piles of cash being passed from person to person for very short periods. And that's how prices went through the roof. Effectively, the entire monetary stock was being turned over within a period of about 3 or 4 days because nobody was holding on to cash.
So this general, to get inflation, the velocity of money has to increase. I love this idea that though first the money has to slosh slowly, like we've just tipped up a bathtub, right, that's half full, and we have to wait for it to slosh down to the short end where it all piles up, and then the velocity is just going to be increasing as it goes. And what you've suggested here is that it's a process. It's not an event. And that process has been initiated. The event is we flipped a switch. QE did that, and the money is currently piling up, heading towards the shallow end of the pool here, where it'll stand up into a giant wave, and velocity will increase, and all of that. So, in your mind, that process is kicked off. Let's get to the heart of it then, though. What does this mean to gold, and when? I think you're on record. You projected a price of gold for it's $3,800 an ounce. How did you get there? I assume we've just talked through some of the logic, but tell us how you get there and when. You can use a range if you want. Yes,
I'm going to be a little bit picky because I didn't really I don't predict a target in the way that most people do. What I'm interested in doing is coming up with a reference price where there seems to me to be some basis for saying that there's a fundamental value to gold at this level. And then depending on where it is with respect to the current price, I will either buy or sell. Anyway, the calculation I used was based on risk and reward scenarios, depending on inflationary outcomes, all of which are uncertain. There's a bit of probability in it. There's a bit of net present value calculation in it. But they're the sort of things which insurance actuaries use when they're working out the value of risks. But it's very easy for anybody who's reasonably numerate to see how the calculations work. And in fact, I've put this on a spreadsheet and people can download it. Anyway, I used this calculator in primarily two different scenarios. And the first thing I did was I took historic economic data, which goes back over about 200 years, thanks to a very good book by Professors Reinhardt and Rogoff.
It's a great
book. You may have heard of. It's called This Time is Different. And it's got 200 years of data to play with. And I used that data as best I could to evaluate the probabilities of different levels of currency devaluation over the coming 15 years. And that was a scenario using the raw data from Reinhardt and Rogoff, which resulted in me coming up with a net present value for gold based on risk reward of 3,844, which is the number that everyone's talking about. But in many ways, it was the next scenario which I did, which was, I thought, more interesting, because I adjusted the risk probabilities to force the calculated value down to the current price of somewhere around $1,400. And what jumped out then was that to get down to about $1,400, you have to be incredibly generous on future inflation scenarios. And you have to discount the hyperinflation risk effectively to zero. And I think this is the error that the market is making. The risk of serious inflation is much, much higher than people realize. People always get probabilities wrong. It's what caused, effectively, the subprime crisis. If they've never experienced something directly, they tend to think the probability is zero, and that's wrong. I think the market has got our future inflation scenarios risked all wrong as well. And once you get to see that picture of what's happening to the debt mountain and how it's slowly shifting to the short end, the risks become very obvious and very material. So I thought that was the interesting part, the fact that the market at this price seems to be discounting zero risk of hyperinflation. But when I look at the history and the data, I think that risk is not zero. In fact, in my 3,800 valuation, I put the risk only at about 5%. And that's pretty tame next to the historical scenarios of people who've started printing money and who always find it very difficult to stop that. So I think, you know, it's pretty 3,800 was a, if you look at the presentation and if you look at the spreadsheet, I think you'll see they are largely cautious projections of data that I've used in coming to that number. And they are based around this abuse of our currency systems by principally quantitative easing and what that's done.
Cautious, 5% hyperinflation risk over 15 years, that's not cautious. That's beyond cautious. You could make a case to make that number much higher. Maybe you add a whole zero to that, given current policies. It's phenomenal. The amount of printing that we've seen, I don't know, has historical precedent because of the nature of the fact that a reserve currency is involved in this one.
Well, I think that's right. I agree with you. I think I'm being very cautious when I talk about a 5% hyperinflation risk. But if you put those, all we're doing with this number, $3,800, all we're doing is saying, look, I've got a choice. I can hold my $1,400 in cash, or I can hold an ounce of gold at the current price. Looking at all these risks and trying to cast things forward by 10 or 15 years, which is the better decision? And if the probability of hyperinflation is anything like 5%, you can take it from me, the better bet is to hold in your hand an ounce of gold than $1,400, because essentially your $1,400 are doomed to be worthless.
Right. This is a really hard concept for people who haven't directly experienced, and I'm sure even for myself, but reading the history books and doing the best I can, having read This Time It's Different and studied a few hyperinflationary periods, they just have a habit of doing what they do. They're like fires. They burn. And at the end of it, everybody wakes up and they have a lot of zeros on their currency that they don't recognize. And it's happened. It's happened a lot. In fact, I would go so far as to say that it's something you should expect to happen, not something you should be deeply surprised by if it happens. It seems to be rather the terminal fate of, as Voltaire said, almost all paper money. There's some dynamic there which just seems to reassert itself through all generations, through all moments of economic history, whether we're in the middle of an industrial boom or whether we're in the middle of a depression. These things seem to just sort of raise themselves again and again.
Interestingly, it's not just about seeming, because one of the great things of that Reinhardt and Rogoff book, in fact, I don't know if you know Neil Ferguson, who's the who's Harvard professor and a Scot originally, but he used to be over here, but he does a lot of TV work. And he did a very good summary of the Reinhardt and Rogoff book. And when you look at it, it's not just this sort of thing that seems to come out of nowhere. It is very strongly likely, once public debt exceeds 90% of GDP, that's a sort of magic number. You get to 90%, there is no way back. And that is the number that the US is going through pretty much as we speak. It's also the number which the UK has gone through. All the pigs are going through it as well. They're all going past the 90% debt to GDP ratio. Obviously, Japan is miles past it already. It's up at 200 and something percent. There doesn't appear in the historical analysis to be any great likelihood of getting back from that level of debt safely. So it isn't just about seeming to be something which turns up. There is this strong evidence that above 90% debt to GDP, you will experience either a cataclysmic default, which is only really going to happen if you've got a rock solid backing like a gold currency or something like that. Either you're going to experience a default, or you're going to experience some form of very serious inflation.
Right. And that risk is one that I've actually had my eye on for quite a while. It's part of the reason I started investing in gold. Also silver. Although silver has dual characteristics to me, I love its industrial applications. What are your thoughts on silver in this story?
Well, I'm a bit of a... I don't really know silver at all. We started doing silver at Bullion Vault about 18 months ago. And I don't really know silver. I just went out and bought some. And I ran with it for about 8 months. And it seemed to have gone up an awful lot by the summer, so I sold half of it. I'm glad I only sold half of it, because it's gone up an awful lot faster since then. So I don't really feel like I'm a silver expert. The big difference for me, for the two of them, is that gold has a very large and stable base. Now, as you know, the silver inventory is much smaller. So because it tends to be used up, the silver inventory can pretty much be consumed by willing investors very quickly. And the storage story at the moment is that the vaults, the bullion vaults, are all completely full of silver bars, most of which, of course, are privately owned or ETF-owned. And that can produce very sharp spikes. So I think silver is always going to be more volatile. I think there's also a psychological element, which is that silver tends to be more attractive to the general investing public, and that's because they do struggle to buy something as small as an ounce of gold for $1,400, and just somehow silver seems more substantial for your money. So what we see here at Bullion Vault is a mixture, but probably... I would say the bigger sums of money tend to be going to gold, and they tend to be long-term, and they tend to be... I mean, one of the things we see here is a lot of bankers buying gold, which is sort of mildly surprising. None of them would have bought it before 2008, but we do see quite a lot of them buying it, and they sort of get something which they never understood before. Silver is just, to me, it's a harder thing to understand. There are more variables in the problem. It's certainly more volatile. And I'm just glad I didn't sell all the silver I bought last year.
Yeah, I'm sure. I think it's over 38 right now. It's certainly on a tear. But it is a different metal, and it's got its own dynamics and characteristics. And I like it for a bunch of reasons. But sticking to gold for a minute, I still run into people who have essentially zero exposure to gold or precious metals. So I'm looking for your advice on how investors should build a position in the precious metals. Now for me, that meant going out and buying some physical coins because I wanted a core portfolio of actual physical metal. And then I started dabbling in miners. And then I actually have a bullion vault account. And then I started looking into allocated storage in a variety of places. So I started to spread things around. My core started with physical metal, but how do people get started in this? I mean, people thinking about physical versus allocated, places like Bullion Vault, maybe ETFs, mining stocks, all of that. How do you get people started in this? And what specifically does Bullion Vault answer to and help remedy in that story?
I think there was about 20 questions there, Chris. I'll try and remember some of them anyway. I'm a bit biased because the way Bullion Vault came into existence, it was essentially exactly what I was looking for. So it obviously suits me. I'm pleased that it suits quite a lot of other people too. Personally, I don't like coins. I have 3 or 4 ounces at home. My problem with coins is, well, there's three problems, really. There's cost. Retail gold tends to have huge markups, and I want to buy gold at the price I see published on the internet or in the paper and not pay a 7% premium to a dealer. Secondly, there's insurance. I do think bullion that you own should be insured, and it's very, very expensive to insure gold at home. So before you buy any coins, my feeling is you should check out the cost of insurance or try and get your broker to give you an insurance quote. But most of all, by far the biggest problem I have with coins is the potential for exchange controls. If you think of all the places that have broken down in our lifetimes, places like Argentina or Zimbabwe or Portugal, you end up trapped behind exchange controls and usually with intense regulation of gold, which means you've got to hide it very well and you can't use it at the time of its maximum utility to you as a saver. So in my opinion, the best place to own gold is safely at arm's length, and that's probably why so many of our customers choose to vault in Switzerland. I think you mentioned ETFs as well. I don't have a big problem with ETFs. I think they're quite useful. They're not ideal for me. I don't particularly like my gold being controlled through a trust. That's probably my main objection. Trusts tend to wrap you in a jurisdiction where they're set up. So if a trust deed is drawn up in London, then it will be subject to British law. And I don't particularly want to worry about what a challenge to that trust deed, whether that might come from a government or a trustee or anybody else. I don't feel the need to have a trust deed between me and something as simple as gold. I just want to own the gold, period. We spoke briefly about unallocated before. I wouldn't touch unallocated gold. The whole point of a gold investment to me is that you are off balance sheet risk. So I'm only interested in allocated bullion, and that's the only bullion we deal at Bullion Vault. The other thing, from the point of view of ETFs, I think they're a little bit pricey in the storage cost. I think 0.4% cost of carry, which is fairly typical, is, well, I know it's about 4 times the wholesale rate. We do take a small margin out of our storage, but we're charging 12 basis points, not 40. So we're less than a third of the cost of storing. But the main issues for me would be to own physical bullion in a country which doesn't have a big trade deficit or a big budget deficit. I would like to be able to go and claim withdrawal if I needed it. What's more useful to me is to be able to sell it in a form which is accepted on a liquid international bullion market. And the reason for that is quite simply, I won't have to accept a discount when I sell. I will be able to sell at the world market price in a legal marketplace and get full value for what I've been so careful to buy and store. That's ETFs, that's coins. I think you mentioned mines. The difficulty mines have been having, and you can see this very clearly on the if you look at a 5-year price chart, for example, of a gold mine, or certainly most of the majors, the difficulty is the political cost, which has steadily built up on mining production. So, for example, if you find some gold now, or if you're trying to bring some mine into production, you're going to get that extraction license, you're going to have to bid up things like, you're going to have to pay for schools, hospitals, roads, you're going to have to set a huge budget aside for regreening a landscape. And I suppose gold mining has deserved that over the years, because it's left many landscapes poisoned and utterly ruined. So I don't think we can oppose that, and I don't think the politics will oppose that. But what it means is that governments will tend to allow or to demand for an extraction license ever more money until the cost of production is pretty marginal. And what that means is they've ratcheted in very high returns for the government, and there's probably only $200 or $300 left for the miner. And because the costs have been ratcheted in, any dip in the bullion price really impacts the profitability of the mine. In fact, it throws it into loss. I was at the LBMA conference in the autumn, and the all-in cost of exploration and extraction had risen from about $350 8 years ago to $950. So this was taking all sorts of mines into loss-making territory, if it weren't for the fact that the gold price had moved so far forward. And in fact, if you look at the share prices, if you look at the dip in the gold price in 2008, it was greatly amplified in all the mining stocks, to the point where if you look at them now over 5 years, even on a massive bull market for gold bullion, the mines underperform bullion. All of the major mines underperform bullion, unless there's one or two that have just gone into royalty arrangements and they still outperform just. But bullion, mines are supposed to be a geared play on bullion. They should have fixed production costs and variable revenues, which vary with the gold price. But it turns out that what they've got is very variable production costs, because these extra costs keep on being applied by governments people who want to extract gold from the ground. So that's the problem with mines, and it's in the data. You look at the share prices, as I say, over 5 years, and you'll see the ungeared, safe option has outperformed the geared play, which is very strange. What else did you ask me about? You know, I've done some coins, and I've talked about... You asked me about Bullion Vault itself.
Right. I want to find a little bit more about Bullion Vault. And in the interest of full disclosure, I want anybody listening to this to know that not only am I a customer of Bullion Vault and have been for a number of years, that my website has an affiliate relationship with Bullion Vault, meaning that if somebody clicks on a link in our site and goes to Bullion Vault, funds an account, and then buys gold, some little bit comes back and helps support our efforts. It doesn't add any cost to anybody on their end, but it's a wonderful program to help support us as well. And it's something I believe in. I truly think that enabling people to get into gold in a very liquid, very facile, very easy way, where you can actually, do it through the internet as well and see what you're holding, it solves a lot of problems, and particularly, the jurisdictional pieces you mentioned, the insurance pieces, making sure it's allocated, having it in custody so that you can avoid any sort of legal entanglements should there be some sort of trouble with a parent company. All of those are elements that I looked for and needed to see in any arrangement that I would get involved in, because I think it's the safety of my holdings is paramount to me. And is there something I've left out of the Bullion Vault story in there that's really important?
Well, no, that's very kind of you to say all those things. We just like to be very simple and very efficient, and that's really what the Bullion Vault model is. Just to summarize, we've got a deep stock now of professional market physical bullion stored in our vaults. It's owned directly by about 20,000 people. And of course, you didn't mention the exchange. These holders of gold, they all compete on our online exchange to buy and sell gold and silver between each other. And that keeps the pricing very, very competitive, both for buyers and for sellers. Now, of course, we keep our own stock in the vault too, and we offer it for sale on that exchange. And if we're cheaper than all our customers, people will buy their gold from us, and then we simply reload with new stock from the professional bullion markets. So it's fairly seamlessly integrated with the deepest bullion market in the world, and it acts basically as a window for private investors onto the professional bullion markets. So that's pretty much it. Obviously, you have to pay your money in upfront, usually by bank transfer, but then you're online and buying your gold. And most people own physical gold, usually in Switzerland, which is our most popular vault. They usually own it the day after they find our site and sign up. And then the following day, of course, they see their gold on our public reconciliation, which proves the gold is there and that it's accounted within our complete stock. And they can get their reconciliation record downloaded automatically to their computer every day, which is a bit like a daily gold balance certificate for them. I don't think there's anything like it anywhere else in the world. Obviously, we've been carefully vetted by the World Gold Council too, and we're now the only recommended retail investment bullion service.
Oh, absolutely. And just to be very clear, if somebody wants to take possession of their gold, they could do that.
Yes, they can, but it's worth saying we're deliberately designed not to be a route for gold in your hand. Gold in your hand is what causes retail gold to be so expensive. If we put into somebody's hand a large number of coins or even full bullion bars, we have to go to a lot of expense in terms of anti-money laundering and security. So you're allowed to, but we charge a fee for both. The current position is that the fee for taking possession of a 400-ounce bar is 2.5%, and the fee for taking possession of small coins or small bars is 7.5%. And that takes us up, let's be honest, to slightly above the cost that you would pay if you went straight to a coin merchant. But what almost all of our investors, so far we've done, I think, 4 deliveries into physical possession. What almost all our customers want to do is invest in gold, hold it remotely, typically in Switzerland, and then they expect to sell it on that main market. It's worth, perhaps I should mention good delivery and how good delivery works. The reason the professional market is so efficient is that the bars which they use are manufactured by a closed list of refiners. They're then sent directly into a closed group of vaults, which are called good delivery vaults. And then from there, as they're traded between the professionals, they only pass between those accredited vaults, and they always move via accredited couriers. And the effect of that is that there's a full audit trail of where every bar has been, and it means that on a spot sale, you simply deliver one of those bars to the buyer's vault, and he immediately pays you in full. Now, that just doesn't happen, at least not at the same pricing, if you go to a retail coin merchant. So what we're trying to do, or what we're doing for people, is we're enabling them to participate in that incredibly efficient delivery and very safe system, which lets people get paid very quickly. That's the primary source of the savings people get on Bullion Vault.
There's a trust factor in there as well. So I'm pretty comfortable buying coins because I'm almost positive I could spot a fake, by myself. But a bar, there's a lot of ways you could fool me with a bar. It's a very sensitive set of assays to figure out if it's a fake or not. You know, with a drilled core or maybe these tungsten things we've heard about. Who knows? So again, if you're trading in larger amounts, I just can't imagine how you would do that outside of the good for delivery system. That part would be mysterious to me, and it would be fairly complicated and fairly intensive, I would think.
And worrying, permanently worrying. Mm-hmm. But within the good delivery system, no false bar has been found in anyone's memory. So they don't circulate. Some people get worried about it. I know there's been a lot of writing about tungsten bars. What happens with most gold, just so as you know, there's a sort of permanent check on the quality of the good delivery system. What happens, about 50% of gold production eventually gets converted into jewelry. And quite a lot of that comes out of the good delivery system. So a standard size 400-ounce bar would come out, and it would actually be converted probably into kilo bars, which would then be sold to jewelers for jewelry manufacture. Well, both that process of producing 1 kilo bars and the subsequent working of those bars, you couldn't work a tungsten bar. No jeweler would be fooled by tungsten. It's very difficult material to work with. And gold, of course, is famously easy to work with. So the fact that these bars are always passing out of the good delivery system and into industrial use, so I use the word industrial loosely there because it is primarily for jewelry production, is a very tight control on the fact that this system is very, very reliable indeed. And, of course, there's a guarantee on it. So all the people who know that bullion has never left that chain of integrity. There's a chain of claims that exists. So when we buy good delivery bullion from a bullion bank and they deliver it, if there is any question mark over that bar, it goes all the way back to where it first came in, which of course is the refiner, and the refiner is accountable. So there's not only our funds guarantee the quality of the bullion, but so does the chain of integrity, which is, you know, for me, it's obviously I wouldn't be very comfortable with several thousand bars in our vaults if I felt that there was a danger of some of them not being right.
Yes, I love this helping to demystify what goes on in that world. It's been operating for a long time. There's safeguards, there's mechanisms by which chain of custody and quality are both assured all the way throughout the process. And that's really an important thing, particularly for people who are dealing with fairly large amounts of money. This is just an absolutely vital piece. So it's gold is not as easy as just picking up the phone and buying 100,000 shares of IBM, which has its own set of processes and other things to assure safeguards of your money there. But it sounds like there are ways to do it very safely, very easily, and Bullion Vault has sort of mastered that in some way.
No, that's what I hope anyway, and I think that is the case.
Well, fantastic. So is there any question I didn't raise or forgot to ask? Is there something else here that we should know about?
Well, sometimes I get slightly frustrated by people who think that the world is going to melt down entirely. And if I'm allowed, I'd like to finish with a short story.
Please.
About a guy I met. Can I do that?
Yes, please.
This story comes from Portugal, back in around about 1984. And if you know about anything about Portuguese history, what happened to the Portuguese is their society essentially melted down in the 1970s. Their politics, their budgets were all in a mess. Their politics swung from extreme left to extreme right. The escudo, which was their currency then, rapidly devalued through inflation. And the process pretty much wiped out the Portuguese middle classes. This meant that Portugal was an incredibly cheap place to visit in the early 1980s, when I was about 23, 24, I guess. And a little group of friends, we used to like playing golf and bridge, we used to fly to Portugal on the Portuguese National Airline, which was TAP. And the Portuguese National Airline never had any Portuguese people on it at all. And the reason was that no Portuguese people could afford the plane tickets. So TAP was busily marketing to tourists from London, from Stockholm, from Paris, from Bonn, and we were flying down to southern Portugal to play golf and, in our case, bridge as well. Anyway, I'd been doing this for two or three years and never seen a Portuguese person on the plane. And I was sitting there one day when a 50-year-old guy was sitting down next to me, he was doing very well, and the air hostess came up and asked him, what would you like to drink? And he answered in Portuguese, which was a huge surprise to her because she hadn't had a Portuguese customer for years. Anyway, he was a very engaging traveling companion, and we chatted for about 2 hours during the flight. And this guy has got a lesson for all of us, because in 1970, he had a concrete business. It wasn't a very big one. It was sort of, you know, looked after a small town in the south of Portugal. And he was making a bit of money, but he wasn't a wealthy guy. And then one of the big local regional companies decided to buy his business, and he thought about it, and then he thought, well, actually, I don't like the political or the economic situation here. It looks unstable. So he took the decision to sell, and he sold his business, and he put all the proceeds into gold in Switzerland, mainly because he wasn't quite sure what to do.
Mm-hmm.
Well, for the next 10 years, the escudo went through the floor, and of course, gold, because of monetary concerns all over the place, it went up about 15 times in real terms, and that's in dollars, not in escudos.
Mm-hmm.
So at the end of 1980, this guy was so wealthy, he went back to Portugal and he bought out the company which had bought him with lots of change left over. So he'd got himself a 10 times bigger company and still got a whole load of money in the bank. And then, of course, what happened is a building boom took off because Portugal was recovering. So this was the guy who was taking concrete to all the villas that were being built in around the south of Portugal, mm-hmm. in the area called the Algarve. And the reason I like this story is because the total failure of Portugal in that period didn't mean you needed a gun or a stockpile of food. There were still people driving around in Mercedes, just not very many of them.
Mm-hmm.
There are still business in Argentina, for example, in 2001, when things melt down. There are still people. It's a normal thing all over the world. There are a small proportion of wealthy people. And the currency devaluation, which I think we're going to experience, we should all view as a massive opportunity. Because if we understand it, we can effect the same switch in position from being relatively modest businessmen to being one of the local tycoons simply by sidestepping the slump that goes with currency devaluation and then stepping back in when things improve. We don't need a gun and we don't need a stockpile of food. The best thing we need is something like gold. I'm not saying it has to be gold, but something like gold, which we've put out of harm's way, that we can call on again when the time is right to invest in our local economies where we live and create jobs for people and grow businesses all over again, perhaps for the second or third or fourth time. And so that's why I like the story. I don't know if that was useful.
Well, that story is almost my story, but much more modestly in my case. Gold to me has always been a transition element. It's helping me manage the transition from a love and fascination of all things paper to some different reality, and we'll get there eventually. And gold is my way of sidestepping, but it's not a one-way be-all dead-end kind of a thing for me. It's definitely got to come back out and go out and do its productive things, but I'm still in sidestep mode at the moment, personally. There's not anything hugely compelling to me in the landscape, but other people see it differently. That's what makes markets.
Yeah, I share that entirely. I don't intend to spend my life in gold. It's a backstop while things are bad, and I look forward to be able to do much more with my modest reserve when the economic landscape is fundamentally healthier again.
Excellent. Well, on that note, I need to thank you from the bottom of my heart for your time. You've been very generous, and this has been illuminating. I learned some very important things here, and so thank you very much.
Chris, thank you very much indeed.
All right. We'll talk to you soon, I hope. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye.
This concludes this podcast by Chris Martinson. To gain further insight into where things stand today and what might happen tomorrow, please visit chrismartinson.com. That's chrismartinson.com. Please join Chris Martinson next time to continue your journey toward awareness, understanding, and action.